Breach, your deep dive into authoritarianism and corruption in the era of Trump. I'm your host, Lindsay Beierstein. The Breach is a production of Rewire.news, your home on the web for cutting-edge reporting and commentary on reproductive health, rights, and justice. If you're enjoying the show, please take a moment to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. It really helps new people find out about the program. My guest today is journalist, author, and pundit Sarah Kendzior. Sarah was one of our very first guests on The Breach back in April, and she's back today to update us on the rapidly unspooling story of Russian interference in the 2016 election. Sarah got her PhD studying post-Soviet states and speaks Russian, and she's been following Trump's Russia ties since long before the election. Just FYI, we're taping this interview on November 13th because I'm going on vacation. I'll be sipping sangria in Barcelona by the time you hear this, so it's possible, just possible, that more news will have broken in the interim. Sarah, welcome to the program.
Oh, thanks for having me back.
You are our second ever guest on The Breach, and when you came on in April to talk about Trump and Russia, so now we're having you back. What would you say have been the most significant discussions in that whole scenario since then?
Oh, wow. I mean, that's like an eternity in Trump time. You know, I guess last time we talked, James Comey had not been fired yet. I think that his firing in May, you know, set forth a series of events, you know, including Mueller taking over the case, forming a team, and also just a general realization among the public that this is serious. This is not a conspiracy in the sort of, you know, paranoid and unbelievable sense. It's a conspiracy in the sense of, you know, multiple parties are complicit in an illicit operation to undermine the integrity of the U.S. government and, you know, do other things to benefit themselves financially. And, you know, this is an international conglomeration of people. And so I think, you know, folks grasp that now. The list of people that have been implicated in this operation has grown longer. And of course, we've had an indictment. You know, we've had a couple indictments. And I think that, you know, that development 2 weeks ago today was probably the most significant thing since then.
I feel like we should exchange cards or something as the two-week anniversary of Indictapalooza.
Yeah. I can't believe it's only been 2 weeks and, you know, keep hoping there's another Mueller Monday and a Flindightman and, I mean, you know, and all that. So we'll see.
Dana Priest, the former Intel beat reporter of the Washington Post, has a piece in the New Yorker where she accuses the intelligence community of committing an intelligence failure, of failing to recognize Russia's interference in our election, a failure on par with their biggest blunders of the Bush years. Do you think that's a fair assessment?
Yeah, unfortunately, I do think that's fair. I think that especially in the second half of the Obama administration, they were not on the ball in terms of how they dealt with Russia in generally. They cut a lot of the funding and positions in various departments, including intelligence, to study Russia. I don't think they had a great grasp on cyber technology and cyber warfare. They tended to focus mostly on ISIS, you know, which of course is a serious threat. And I think they underestimated the capacity of Russia to intervene in foreign countries to the degree that they have. And, you know, the other thing, of course, that they did was to not go public with all of this earlier. You know, like the intelligence agencies were aware of the situation by mid-2016. You know, Harry Reid had written about it publicly and asked people like Comey to go public. And I think that some of the skepticism that's been expressed towards this is that it was talked about much more after the election than before. So that made it seem partisan, like, oh, people are just angry and they want to blame Russia and they're upset that Trump is in and this is a way to get him out. It's like, no, you know, this is a nonpartisan national security problem. And the sooner people grasp that, the better, because it really does affect everybody. And so I do wish that the Obama administration had handled things differently.
It's so ironic because the reason they didn't go forward with it earlier was that they didn't want it to sound partisan before the election. It's like there was no right time to bring up the fact that Russia was meddling in our election.
Yeah, exactly. And that's so it's very frustrating. I mean, in one sense, I understand because, of course, the Republicans would have attacked Obama. And of course, they would have framed it as partisan. And of course, the media would have framed it as partisan. But just because they're going to do that doesn't make it true. And there would have been no good time. They should have just gone forward because it's their obligation as elected officials who serve the public to inform the public of a national security threat. That's the reason. And they would have had to fend off people like Mitch McConnell, you know, who has expressed, you know, out loud that that was his intent, was to try to reframe this as some sort of partisan plot. And that itself is very disturbing. That's not really the way he should be thinking about a threat like this. But, you know, it's what they needed to do, and they didn't do it.
You have a doctorate in studying former Soviet states. As the government's capacities in terms of monitoring and understanding Russia were dwindling, was that something that people in that community of scholars were talking about and lamenting at the time?
Oh, absolutely. I gave a keynote speech at Indiana University, I think in 2014. 2015. And I remember calling my keynote speech a eulogy, because it was in the Central Eurasian Studies Department. And, you know, jobs were disappearing, funding was disappearing, research was disappearing, academic positions, NGO positions, and positions in the government, which used to be, you know, fairly robust throughout the Bush era, at least for Central Asia. There was interest in those countries because they bordered Afghanistan. We had military bases there. They were kind of undercovered before. But also there were a lot of Russia scholars, especially around the time of the sequester, that were like, hey, you know, there's a lot going on with Russia. This is not where you should be doing cuts. If you're going to cut, this is not a safe place to do this. You should actually be investing more attention to Russia. And then, of course, Russia went and invaded Crimea shortly after, you know, proving them right. And I kind of thought at that point, all right, they're going to get serious. They're going to realize that, you know, Russia is newly aggressive and take these threats seriously. And I mean, you know, they did improve a little, but they just didn't realize the capacity or the scope. And I think that they were also very overwhelmed with other foreign policy crises, you know, some of which are related to Russia, you know, like Syria. But I think they had a lot on their plate and they weren't balancing it well.
What are some of the things as an area expert in this kind of thing that you see the media missing in their coverage of Russia? What kind of things jump out at you?
Well, it's gotten more thorough lately. I mean, for the longest time, just convincing people, you know, that this was happening, that the Trump team was working with, you know, oligarchs and Kremlin officials and people connected to them. That was something that was very difficult to get people to believe. And now what you're seeing is an investigation that's enormous in scope, taking in money laundering, espionage, cybersecurity, you know, the possibility of treason, all these angles. So I do think the coverage is pretty good. I wish there was more written by people who spoke Russia. I wish there was more analysis of, you know, Russian media. I think when you look back at what Russian media and Russia's state media was doing in 2014, 2015, and the years leading up to this, it's very interesting. Like a lot of really damning American, you know, English language materials that I found about Trump, I found through reading Russian language websites that were very excited about them. Like when Trump did an interview about Crimea on Fox News in February 2014, you know, which is very strange. Like, why is the host of The Celebrity Apprentice on Fox News talking about Crimea? You know, I found that because Russian state media outlets were really excited about it because Trump was for Russia to be a superior country and, you know, saying that, you know, the U.S. is going to do a great favor for Russia in the future. He was very mysterious about it. So I just wish there were more people who spoke Russia that were doing kind of hard digging and research into this. And I suspect there are in the intel community and in academia, but it's not necessarily getting translated to the public.
This is kind of blowing my mind. What year did they have Trump on to say?
In February 2014, during the Olympics, during the Sochi Olympics. And he was on talking about Russia, defending Putin. He was also calling for riots, for an economic crash, for everything to go to total hell to make America great again. And then he just kept saying, we need to go easy on Russia. We need to be Russia's friend because they're going to be doing us a favor in the future. And, you know, we're going to be glad about that. It was an absolutely bizarre interview. I've referenced it numerous times, but no one noticed it because I think it just seemed like, okay, crazy Donald Trump is on TV blabbing away about stuff he doesn't know. I mean, that's like basically every Donald Trump interview. So I don't think that people at that time realized the significance of him talking about Russian foreign policy. But in retrospect, you know, especially because we know everything Russia was doing during that period, it looks pretty damning.
Has anyone asked him about that interview?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I've written about it several times. And, you know, a couple of radio shows and stuff have played excerpts after I found it. But what was frustrating to me is I found this interview back in, I think, June 2016. And I was like, holy, holy cow. I don't know if I can swear on this show.
Yeah.
I couldn't believe what I was seeing because, you know, it was showing that, yes, Trump had had interactions with Putin. He admitted in the interview. It showed his whole philosophy, which is basically, let's have everything be destroyed so that people can, like himself, could financially benefit from it. And it, you know, had this implication that there was some sort of deal being struck behind the scenes with Russia that was going to benefit it. And it was at a very strange time. Like, this was kind of before the Republicans had embraced Russia and Putin openly. Like, even the Fox News hosts that interviewed him were a little bit like, you know, gee, Donald, you really think so? And, you know, and of course, this just became their party line a couple years later. And now they're, you know, Kremlin, you know, advocates. But it really stood out. And I could not get people to really take it seriously. Like, I was sort of surprised that, you know, this interview wasn't all over the place, because as Trump was out there saying, I have nothing to do with Russia, I've never had anything to do with Russia, there's like this really damning interview talk with him bragging about all the stuff he has to do with Russia. And I'm like, okay. And, you know, that was a lot of my frustration was in 2016, was just, you know, people's refusal to look at Trump's own words. You know, it had nothing to do with a big conspiracy, you know, by secondhand or thirdhand sources saying things about him. It was just the stuff coming out of his own mouth that was so incredibly damning, and people just didn't pay enough attention.
Where do you think Trump's attachment and admiration for Russia comes from?
I think it's multifaceted. I think there's some kind of ideological or philosophical component in that Trump generally admires dictators. He admires strongman governments. He admires oligarchs. I think that he has oligarch envy. I think if he could, he would have lived like an oligarch in the United States, you know, free of the kind of rules and regulations that we have. Although obviously we do not have enough regulations because people like Trump and his cabinet members managed to can come to power. You know, and I think that that's what he wanted. And I think he's worked directly with Russian financiers throughout his whole career, but especially after his bankruptcies in the 90s, they propped up his business and gave him money when nobody else wanted to work with him because he was very high risk. And I think that it's possible he owes them quite a bit of money. And so I think there's an aspect of debt. I think there's an aspect of greed where certain policies, like removing the sanctions, could prove beneficial to the Kremlin, to the oligarchs that back the Kremlin, to Trump and to Trump's cronies in the U.S., to plutocrats here. And of course, there's also, you know, the issue of compromise, which has been brought up. And I do think the compromise is real. I don't know if the specific allegation in the Steele dossier is real, but I tend to think that, you know, Putin and the Kremlin do have something incriminating on Trump that they are using as insurance. But I don't think they need it exactly yet. I think that Trump is a, you know, a willing participant in this situation and genuinely seems to see eye to eye with them and is extremely deferential. And that's been constant with him for the last 30 years in terms of his attitude towards Russia and especially, you know, towards Putin since Putin took power at the turn of the century.
I wish I could say I was shocked, but at least it made an impression when Trump called the intelligence community political hacks and sided with Putin about the interpretation of the 2016 election recently.
Yeah, I mean, it's not shocking in, you know, the sense that we don't expect him to say something like that, but there's a, you know, a surreal aspect that this is our president and he's expressing greater loyalty to a hostile foreign state that's hacked us than he is to our own intelligence services in our own country on Veterans Day. At that, I thought the phrase political hacks was notable because in July, I think it was July 29th, 2016, shortly after Trump had, you know, had his last press conference of the campaign where he'd asked Russia to release Hillary's emails. And I think his handlers are like, whoa, you know, we need to get this guy off the stage. He gave this speech that was really rambling and crazy. And I wrote about that too, where he kind of had a confession. He kind of had this big breakdown and he was like, you know, I work with the worst people in the world and, you know, I need to do it. And I, you know, these people are terrible. They stay up all night turning and their bodies covered with sweat. And he's like, but I'd rather work with them because otherwise we just have political hacks. And he kept using, you know, political hacks over and over. And it, you know, it sounded demented, but this is obviously something he's thought about before. Like, I don't think that phrase emerged from nowhere. I think to the degree that Trump has any kind of conscience or coherent philosophy. It's in this idea of, you know, wanting to undermine state that seems in his mind out to get him, you know, the alleged deep state. So basically want to undermine anybody who can impose rules upon him. And that's, I think, what the category of political hacks is in his mind. And those, of course, are public servants. He's against the idea of public servants.
And against the idea of democracy itself, that political hacks are people that are, in some sense, responsible to the people, possibly pandering to the people for their support. But if you've got oligarchs who have their own strength, it's almost a fascistic kind of sentiment.
Oh, yeah. I mean, he is anti-democratic. He's explicitly anti-democratic. You know, he's sat and, you know, ruminated on, why can't I get the Justice Department to just carry out my whims? Why can't I get the FBI to, you know, target private citizens for me? Like, he almost genuinely doesn't seem to understand that the powers of a president are not the powers of a dictator. And I think, you know, this is somebody who has had everything handed to him his entire life, who was born rich and became richer through crime. And I think that he doesn't understand anything outside this narcissistic philosophy. And he also seems terrified by the concept of sacrifice, by the idea of putting anything above yourself. And you particularly see this with the way that he treats veterans, where he's insulted multiple Gold Star families, you know, and he's targeted veterans that are private citizens. He's insulted McCain. And I think that that's because this idea just terrifies him on a fundamental level. And so I think when he thinks of, you know, something like our Foreign Service officers or our intel community, he can't fathom that they're working for anything beyond personal enrichment. Like, the concept baffles him, that they're working for the United States, you know, as a democracy, as a political entity, and as their home. It's beyond him. And I think that that's in part a psychological issue and not even an ideological one.
I mean, it was striking when he was trying to handle that condolence call to the widow of Le David Johnson, saying, you know, well, I guess he knew what he signed up for, which seemed like he was almost telegraphing something Kelly told him, you know, about how, which was much more compassionate when Kelly explained it, that, you know, that this man died doing what he'd always wanted to do, surrounded by the best men in the world, what he'd always wanted to be and achieve. And it's like Trump couldn't even process it, like he was interpreting it from a foreign language and translating it really badly.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to put it. I think that that is genuinely beyond him. And I think that it frightens him. I think it threatens him, the idea that people could fight for something higher than their own material needs or self-promotion. I think when he is up against people who value things, you know, that are not the same values he has, you know, which are all kind of self-enhancement values, he gets afraid because he doesn't understand. And that makes him, of course, incapable of rendering sympathy or empathy towards anyone, which is a horrendous thing for a president to have. I think that they really should not have him deliver these calls. You know, I think it's cruel to our troops. You know, I think any situation that calls for tact and sympathy or diplomacy is not a situation that Trump should be involved in. And the fact that he is at this lever of power and that he can, you know, call world leaders anytime he wants and say whatever he wants, you know, which he has, like his conversations with Australia and Mexico and Canada, you know, are just horrifying. He needs to be controlled. And there's really no one who can control him, unfortunately.
Has any progress been made on actually imposing sanctions that Congress ordered against Russia for their meddling in the election?
Not in this country. I think Canada's imposed some for Magnitsky. No, I mean, I wish, actually, when you asked what hasn't been reported on thoroughly, that's something that hasn't been reported on thoroughly, is whether the sanctions are being upheld in practice. You know, it took him a long time to sign them. To my knowledge, they have not been effectively upheld. I've heard some things about, you know, certain repercussions for, you know, Russian financiers and oligarchs, but not kind of thorough reporting. And I don't know if it's because information on that is difficult to obtain or just, you know, people haven't filed their reports, but that's certainly something people should be looking into.
People have been using the phrase Russian orphans as synonymous with the Magnitsky Act. Could you unpack that and explain how those two concepts relate to each other?
Oh, I mean, Russian Orphans was the cover story that Donald Trump Jr. used, I believe, when he had the June 9th, 2016 meeting, you know, with all of the various players in this controversy, you know, Manafort and the Russian liaisons and Kushner and, you know, and so forth. You know, initially they said we were talking about Russian orphans and how, you know, we needed to lift the policy, you know, and allow people to adopt. But what it's really connected to are the sanctions that were imposed on Russia because of their human rights violations. You know, these are economic sanctions that Russia very badly wants these sanctions lifted so that they can continue to, you know, purchase properties in the U.S., launder money, you know, all the things that they've been doing basically since the Soviet Union collapsed and they saw investment opportunities here. And so that's what it was really about. They wanted the RNC platform to be changed to reflect that. And then it was. So, you know, that's very damning. I think one of the most, you know, significant and damning things that's happened since we last spoke was Donald Trump Jr. putting those emails on Twitter, which was really a gift to the public and the intelligence community. But I don't know what the hell he was thinking when he did that.
It was pretty amazing. But there was some truth, right, that Russia, was it that Russia in retaliation refused to allow people from the U.S. to adopt Russian orphans? Is that how
Yeah, there were adoptions, I believe, that were stopped, you know, midway, like families that had, you know, children that they were hoping to take home. And yeah, you know, that was a form of retaliation. And I think that this is a way for Russia to paint this as an act of aggression instead of defense by America. You know, they're like, America is being cruel to children. It's being cruel to families that want to adopt, you know, Russian babies. And that takes the focus off of the oligarchs and the financial deals and the human rights violations that Russia, you know, has made, which has gotten much worse over the last 4 to 5 years, basically since Putin got back into power. They're broader, they're targeting groups, you know, like gays and lesbians, much more. They're targeting people in Chechnya. They've had, you know, very aggressive imperialistic ambitions. You know, there's all sorts of stuff going on that they do not want you looking at. They'd rather have you think about, you know, poor Russian babies. But, you know, that was their decision to my knowledge, to, you know, put that policy into play.
What do you think Putin's wish list is going forward in the near term? What kind of concessions would he like to get out of Trump? And what agendas of his would those help advance?
Basically, I think you can figure this out from what Trump has said, because he has trouble, you know, keeping it quiet. I think Putin would like the sanctions dropped. I think that's the main thing. I think he would like the U.S. to withdraw from NATO. I think he would like the U.S. to withdraw from, you know, friendly engagement with the EU. And of course, he would like the EU to weaken, you know, or potentially collapse as well. I mean, he basically wants a weakened West so that they don't constrain him, you know, so that they don't constrain him and, you know, his inner circle financially in terms of investments and in money laundering and, you know, basically criminal activity. He doesn't want to be constrained in the human rights violations. He doesn't want the UN or, you know, other bodies breathing down his neck. And he really wants, I think, to continue, you know, this aggressive expansion of Russian territory into Eastern Europe. I think that he would like to make moves into former Soviet Union territory. This could potentially include the Baltics or parts of Central Asia, as well as Ukraine, you know, where they're already operating. He doesn't want anybody to stand in their way. And so the weaker his rivals are, the better off he feels.
And can you talk a bit about how Russia has been meddling in the affairs of other Western democracies, say in Europe? Like, I think that people often find it hard to wrap their mind around the idea of Russia interfering in U.S. elections because they're not familiar with all these other petri dishes where Russia has been, you know, trying to poison.
Yeah, Russia has been doing this for a long time. And I think the significant change isn't really the extent of their ambitions, but their ability to carry it out. And that's due to changes in technology. I think social media was a huge gift for them. It allowed them to, you know, perform manipulative acts and reach a massive foreign audience very easily, you know, under anonymity. And so, you know, they started out targeting countries in the former Soviet Union. You know, you saw this in Georgia and Ukraine. Ukraine. They tried in countries like Estonia that were, you know, onto them and had a, you know, a bulwark against them. And then they've started to make moves into Western Europe. They were active during Brexit. That's something that's currently being studied, is the connections of people like Nigel Farage to Kremlin officials and, you know, others, Boris Johnson, others involved in Brexit, the use of bots in Brexit. They attempted to get Marine Le Pen elected in France. That wasn't successful, in part because France was aware of these kind of operations and they were warning the public, you know, this is what to look out for in terms of Russian propaganda. You know, they also tried in Germany. You know, I think the world needs to accept that this is what they're going to continue to do. And I think the fine line that people need to hold to is to not go into full-fledged paranoia and just assume, you know, everything is a Russian bot, you know, everything is a Russian operation. It's very difficult for people to maintain relationships of trust online. And I think that, you know, you should be cautious. You know, you should get to know people, you know their history and backgrounds, look for, you know, inconsistencies or whether an account suddenly appeared at a political moment and seems to be backed up by a lot of bots. I mean, just apply some, you know, critical thinking and media literacy to what you see. But I think it would be beneficial, you know, not just to Russia, but to Trump and to anybody who opposes the principles of democracy, for us to all doubt each other, for us to all be incredibly paranoid about who we, quote, really are. And so I think just, you know, be cautious, but also try to work for the greater good within the difficulties of this new cyber environment.
We've got listeners all over the technological sophistication spectrum. Can you give a quick overview of what bots are for somebody who maybe doesn't use Twitter?
Yeah, I mean, people sometimes use bots and trolls interchangeably, and that's not quite right. You know, when I say bot, I'm thinking of an, you know, automated account that is not really run by a human being, that's, you know, often programmed to respond to an algorithm in order to make certain hashtags or people or sentiments public, popular and to resonate with the public. And they can, you know, do things like on Twitter, if enough people are talking about something, it can be pushed into a trending topic. They also can be used to take advantage of pre-existing public interests, you know, things people are already talking about, and try to spin that material so that it reflects a particular political perspective, you know, usually with a fairly inflammatory content or content that, you know, pushes, you know, makes the people that they like Trump or Putin, look good and poses conspiracy theories about those that they don't. And then there's also trolls. You know, there are people that are hired to write these kind of content to impersonate Americans or people of other nationalities, to create an entire persona. And, you know, this is designed for a variety of reasons. Some of it's propaganda. Some of it, I think, is to, you know, basically map social networks online and use that information to give back to those designing these sorts of attacks and see who's friends with who and who can be manipulated and who can, what's useful. And also just to spy on people. You know, there were some Russians that were impersonating Black activists and they were having, you know, direct message exchanges with, you know, actual people in the U.S. and even organizing protests. And they did this with Trump supporters as well. And, you know, they did this with, you know, a Texas secessionist group. And all of that, you know, it helps erode trust and it gives them a lot of material and insight into the American political system. And so, you know, they, all these kinds of things that Russia historically has been very good at doing, these kind of active measures of surveillance and deceit and espionage, they're now able to do really fast and pretty well in a cyber capacity. You know, that's a frightening thing.
So it becomes very easy to develop the cultural expertise that they may have been lacking, that they can just literally ping anybody out on the internet and the receptive people will come in and give them information they probably couldn't buy at any price about how Americans think and live and feel.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's been all this question about, you know, how much help did Americans give them? And I do think that there were Americans who were involved in helping them. I mean, we know who some of them are. Like, that's why Manafort was indicted. That's why Papadopoulos is indicted. But I think in terms of acquiring cultural knowledge, it's not really that hard, you know, to immerse yourself in an internet culture, to get to know people. You know, I'm saying this as an anthropologist. You could basically use like ethnographic techniques to gain this kind of knowledge. And of course, you know, some of these trolls, these Russian trolls are sloppy. You know, the Texas website is a great example of that. You know, it was like, I love Texas shape, like, you know, very obviously.
Texas not, shape is pretty nice though. Very shapely.
It is. At the bottom. Excellent shape. You know, but it's very obvious that this is not a homegrown U.S. effort, but others are slicker. And that's because these guys are professionally trained. You know, this is their livelihood. You know, they are spies. And so that's what they do. And it's a lot easier to be a spy on the internet than it is in real life. And, you know, they can get a lot done and they're very committed to it.
Sarah, that's all the time we have for today. Thank you so much for coming on the program.
Oh, thank you.
And now it's time for recommended reading. A handpicked selection to deepen your understanding of our current political moment. This week's reading comes from A.J. Vinson's in Mother Jones, and it's called Rebuilding Puerto Rico Will Cost $95 Billion, Says Governor. As of mid-November, 60% of the island remains without power, and 70% remains without potable drinking water. Congress has approved $5 billion in aid for Puerto Rico, but most of that is a loan the island will have to pay back on top of the tens of billions of dollars it already owes to bondholders and in outstanding pension obligations. Disaster capitalism is already in full swing on the island. Education Secretary Betsy DeVos has already visited to talk up school privatization. So clearly it's going to be a long road back for our fellow citizens, and we have to all remain vigilant and demand accountability. That's it for recommended reading. The Breach is produced by Nora Hurley for Rewire Radio. Our executive producer is Mark Folletti. Our theme music is Dark Alliance, performed by Darcy James Argue's Secret Society. And I'm your host, Lindsay Beierstein. Follow Rewire at rewire_news for the latest on the issues that matter most. See you next week.